And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Football Show.
Welcome to the Athletic Football Show. I'm Robert Mays. Joining me today, it's my good friend Nate Tice. Nate, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well. Right before the fourth, you got any big plans? Are you staying in Chicago, or what's going on?
I really don't have any huge plans. We got some dinner plans on Friday with friends, and then Saturday we got some plans with friends. Then Sunday, I think I'm getting brunch with my mom and her husband, but nothing crazy. And then I assume I'll be at the grill on Sunday, and whoever wants to come over can come over. How about you?
Yeah, that's kind of it. Nothing really Friday, Saturday, but then Sunday having the friends over and kind of trying to break in the new place and kind of like, all right, see how my hosting abilities are, because I've talked up my hosting abilities for years and years. Oh, once I get a place, yeah, I'm gonna be great, you know, whenever I'm the friend at someone else's place. So I gotta really up my game and see how I do on the fourth.
We're both in a similar situation with new houses that we feel compelled to host people at, even though I don't know, I'm a little apprehensive about it every single time, because it's not furnished yet, and that upsets me. Like, I want it to be done before people are over there, but you can't furnish a house all at once.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend keeps trying to tell me that, and I keep not wanting to listen to it. It's like, no, I want to buy everything right now, even though that's completely unrealistic.
Every time someone comes over, it's a guided tour. It's very much, yes. You are on rails on this tour. Okay. And nope, don't open that door. Oh, here, check this out. Yeah, the bathroom's clean, right? Yeah. So that's kind of what ours is right now. Even getting this office to look presentable, like, you only see the top half. You don't see the bottom half of this room right now, because it's a mess.
Yeah. I wanted to get this done first. So 4th of July, I think, is relevant to the conversation here, because we are in the dregs of the NFL offseason. The NFL is in its very sleepy time. Everyone is gone. There's nothing happening. A lot of people are on vacation. So I wanted to do something that was completely removed from even the current NFL, even though we've been looking back a little bit. I wanted to go way, way back. Every single time you make a case for somebody to be in the Hall of Fame, or an argument for someone to be in the Hall of Fame, there's someone on the internet who inevitably says, that guy shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. He belongs in the Hall of Very Good. So I thought it would be fun to do the Hall of Very Good, a first class for the Hall of Very Good. And so we've talked about this a lot over the last week or so, the parameters associated with this. And they're a little bit complicated, but I want to lay them out for people just so they understand what we were doing and why. These are not guys that we think should be in the Hall of Fame and that deserve cases to be in the Hall of Fame and just have been overlooked for whatever reason. That's another podcast for another time. So there are guys in here that will be too good for this conversation, even though they're not in the Hall of Fame. I'm talking about guys like Andre Johnson, Fred Taylor, Simeon Rice. Those guys are not here. People that have been finalists or semifinalists for the Hall of Fame are not going to be included here. So these are guys that probably don't have a realistic shot of ever getting in. Even in the next 5 to 10 years, they will likely not be Hall of Famers. But we wanted to recognize them in some way, whether their career was cut short because of injury, whether they played a position that maybe isn't as valued, or for whatever reason, they're not going to be Hall of Famers, but we still wanted to talk about them here. So this is similar to the Hall of Fame, 5 years removed from their career. So 2016 was the last season that I used. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to present 5 guys each for the inaugural class of the Hall of Very Good.
Love it. I love it. The HVG.
It legitimately was just a shameless nostalgia play. Like, that's the only reason I wanted to do
it
this.
It really was.
Because we love talking about guys from like 1995 through 2010 on this podcast.
Yep.
When we were the age, we're teenagers, we're in college.
And they primarily played in the central time zone. Yeah.
Yes. Guys that were just people we loved watching growing up in like our formative years as football fans. Yep. And that's what we're going to do here. So I want to start first. I mentioned a couple of those guys. But were there any guys that you felt like were on the edge and you just said, you know what, too good. I just think we cannot include him here for the spirit of the exercise.
I'm glad you said Simeon Rice in your intro, because that was one I was going to hold on to in the until the very end, because that was one I was like, because he is extremely good. He should be a Hall of Famer for all intents and purposes. He's just never got the recognition for whatever reason. Like, he really didn't. He was a top five pick, three-time Pro Bowler, one-time All-Pro, and three-time second-team All-Pro. But the thing was, he ended with 120 sacks, 122 sacks, and like, he just gets no Hall of Fame buzz at all. And he was just a speed. It's because he was a speed rusher back when that was considered almost like a backhanded compliment, when you were just like, oh, he's a pass rush only guy. But he finished with 122 sacks, so.
I also think it's because by the time he got to Tampa Bay, he was like the fourth or fifth banana in those Tampa Bay defenses.
Yep.
Which, because he's overlooked by so many other guys, think about the guys that have gotten in on those defenses. John Lynch, Warren Sapp, Derek Brooks, all of those guys were more prominent than him.
Yes.
Somebody else that was on my list that I think could probably be, you could make a case for him as a Hall of Famer, so that's why I didn't include him here, was John Abraham. John Abraham's career stats are unbelievable, but I just think he's too good for this exercise. And the first guy that I thought of for this, that I ultimately decided he's too good, I think that he was too good and too prominent, was Justin Smith. But I honestly think that 5 years from now, we'll probably have to include him here to remind people that he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Because he, even in his time, like, yes, in, actually, I'm not trying to like sound like include, like just like a bubble here, but it's like in football circles, everyone was like, oh my God, he's one of the best players, one of the best defenders up front. But there was one of those, it's just not, maybe just his name is Justin Smith, and maybe just that's why it's no one recognizes. And just his play style and all that, he just never got that national buzz that like some of these guys get. Like, I would say, man, I don't want to throw him out because I don't know how you're going to go about it. But like, Reggie Wayne was one. Like, I was like, he's way too good.
No, he's way too good.
Way too good. But it's like, you know, he's going to get in the Hall of Fame in due time.
He's way too good.
Leroy Glover was way too good. And then Rondé Barber was one I had to actually just make sure, like, just because he's like the barometer for me was kind of like, that's the cutoff, is a Rondé Barber.
He's been a finalist, though. I think if they've been a finalist, I think that's tough to do if they've been finalists.
So
the other guys that were in this conversation to me, Andre Johnson, I think too good. I don't know if he ever gets in, but I think that there were a lot of stretches where he was like the second or third best receiver in the league. I think injuries, that's what's going to keep him out, because his career stats, the counting stats aren't as good as he probably need to get in. But I think he's right there. I think Jimmy Smith and Fred Taylor both are just a little bit too good. But we're going to have some of these conversations about potential Hall of Famers on a different show. But we just wanted to throw out some of those names so people weren't clear, like, what about this guy?
Yeah.
Too good. If you're curious about it, if you're wondering why we didn't mention someone, the answer is probably because they're too good.
Round down.
Yes, like that's, round down.
It's round down on it. But
the other one that I thought, the group I thought was interesting, is looking at guys that 3 years from now might be in this conversation. A couple of names I wanted to throw out that I thought were perfect here. I think Robert Mathis is going to be right on the edge, if not too good. Jamal Charles, I think, is going to be right on the edge, if not too good. And then two more that I had, Josh Sitton.
Nice.
And I'm curious about this one, because I think he might be way too good. Do you think Jari Evans is a Hall of Famer?
He doesn't get the buzz.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. But no, good. Yeah, that's a good call, though.
If you look at his career, though, I mean, his career is incredible.
I know. Sometimes you look up and you forget how consistent some of these guys are. And then you look at their stats and you're like, oh my God, like 10 and a half sacks year after year, or just like productive, plays 16 games, 10 straight years. And you're just like, that's kind of like, looking back at the time, is never, you talk about in that upper tier, maybe 1 or 2 years in that upper tier. But like, kind of like my cutoff was like, if you had spent a presidential term as like the best at your position, like that is kind of, or best or top three, I should say, that was kind of like, you're too good if you spent more than that. Like, kind of like,
that's fair.
Four or under. I tried to do that at least, because there's one guy, the one guy that we've discussed a lot already before the show's even started, just via text, I'm sure, like, might as well start it off talking about him, right?
Let's do it. Let's get to it.
Okay.
Who's your first one?
Because it's Kevin Williams, and it's hard because we talked about it. He's an all decade.
He's too good. I disagree with this.
I know. And this was kind of, it was so hard, but I want to talk about him. That's why. But all decade team in the aughts, you know, 5-time first team all pro, which, I mean, that already just broke my first rule of more than 4 years right there. but just his versatility. He played for 13 years. He only missed 5 games. Like, he was a pass rushing end. He shifted into 5-tech. He's played 3-tech. He played nose for a few games. Like, he's kind of just did everything. But his like transition of his career, turning him from this kind of like all around player to this run stopping behemoth, like, and just athletic and just a tough out, basically, is the best way to put it. Tough guy to block. And he's been honored. Obviously, he had 5 first team all pros. He was on all decade team, but it's kind of like he's not talked about enough. So that's gonna be my homer pick, and that is gonna be my one exception to the rule is Kevin Williams. And I know you're already gonna say breaks everything right there.
So he was not a semifinalist for the Hall of Fame this year, but I believe it was only his first year of eligibility.
I think so.
So it's not as though he's been looked over all these times. I have to think, being a 5-time first team All-Pro, and that he eventually gets some real consideration, even if he doesn't get in.
He will.
So if you look at it, there aren't that many modern era defensive tackles that have gotten into the Hall of Fame. Like, mm-hmm. Cortez Kennedy is one. But other than that, a lot of the guys at that position played a while ago. I mean, there's some current players that are obviously going to get in. Warren Sapp, obviously, is somebody that did. But, I mean, there aren't that many of them. So it's not that easy to get in at that spot. John Randall is another example. But, I mean, those are huge sack numbers.
They had the sack numbers, exactly. Yes. They're both big, big-time sack numbers. And John Randall, you know, he had national recognition just being in Nike commercials with Favre and all that. That stuff helps. It really does. Just put it in. Because you can get into the people in the football circles' minds, but it's really hard to get into that national brain trust if you're not a QB, you're not like a big fantasy putting up points. Remember, oh, the game-winning touchdown, the game-winning interception. It's like you have to put up sacks and just numbers because it helps arguments just for people that are justifying putting somebody in the Hall of Fame. It just helps for people.
Do you have a receiver on your list?
No.
Me neither, because it was hard to come up with one for that exact reason.
Yeah.
It feels like the receivers that you put in this conversation, by virtue of having the numbers, are probably going to get recognition, or they're considered those, they should be in the Hall of Fame guys, like Jimmy Smith, or a couple of those guys that are right on the edge. So it was hard for me to find a receiver for that exact reason. So, all right, let me throw out my first one here. We'll stick with the just homerific picks. My first one is Charles Tillman. When I was doing this exercise, he is the person that I had in mind, right? Charles Tillman is not going to go to the Hall of Fame. I mean, he was, I believe, only a couple time Pro Bowler. He went to the Pro Bowl twice in a decade-long career. But if you think about what Charles Tillman was over the course of his career, a singular player, unlike really any other corner in the entire NFL, and I think I prioritize that in conversations like this. Were you just in a tier all your own in terms of play style? And that's exactly what Charles Tillman was.
Yeah.
So between 2003 and 2015, Charles Tillman forced 44 fumbles, which was second in the NFL in that 13-year stretch after Robert Mathis. There was no other non-pass rusher in the top 10. Then the next non-pass rusher in that group was Charles Woodson with 23.
Yeah.
So Charles Tillman had twice as many forced fumbles over that stretch than any other non-pass rusher in the entire NFL. And so when we think about Charles Tillman, obviously that's the first thing that comes to mind, right? It's the peanut punch stuff. It's now copied by so many guys throughout the league just because volatility and turnovers have become the way you have to play defense in an offense-forward league. But I really think he was underrated as a corner. He was so perfect in that defense, in that Lovie Smith defense, because when he could play cover two and even when he could play man, he was so physical. He wasn't the fastest guy, wasn't the quickest guy, but when you could really muscle up people, he could do that like few other corners in the NFL. And it was two guys specifically. Remember that fade to Randy Moss's rookie year in 2003?
Did you see me start sitting up? Because I was about to talk about that. When he ripped it out of his hands. Oh, do I remember that? Yeah.
And that was that moment where he kind of came onto the stage and was like, oh, shit. And there are people associated with the league back then that were in the Bears front office that just loved him. Like, I mean, Chris Ballard, like Charles Tillman was his guy before that draft. He loved Charles Tillman. And watching him for his entire career was incredible. And I think he was underrated so much throughout his entire time with the Bears. And then it's funny that 2012 might have been his best season.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two games from that year that stick out to me. One was that game against Tennessee where he forced 4 fumbles. He forced four fumbles in one game. I remember watching that game and I was just laughing by the end. Every single time the ball hit the turf, it was insane. And then they played the Lions on a Monday night. And what he did to Calvin Johnson in that game.
That's right.
It's those Calvin Johnson and Randy Moss type guys. He could play against them in ways that very few corners in the league could, because he could just, he wasn't going to get out muscled by those guys.
He had one against Dallas too. That was awesome. I think it was a Sunday night football game. It was that one. He had one of that game too, that I just remember vividly, because it was like kind of like Dallas was getting a little momentum going, and all of a sudden he just popped it and it was just over. I think the offense scored, and the next one Briggs had the pick six when they like drove down, and then Briggs had like a pick six. That was like 80 yards. Or something.
Yep.
And it was like boom, boom, just two turnovers just like that. That was that Bears defense. That was an incredible defense. But Peanut Tillman, it was just awesome. It's a narrow band of time that he could have been a very good player. You know what I mean? Like, and it's just perfect situation, perfect time period of the league. And it's like, he got it. He got it for that, you know, that chunk of years when Lovie Smith came there, especially. And it's like, awesome player. I love Peanut Tillman.
There will be more Bears conversations over the course of this list, and I will justify them. You watch me justify them. All right, who's your second one?
I know. I'm going to go Homer still. I'm just going to knock them both out. I'm going to go with Matt Burke. And
great one.
Matt Burke is one of my favorite players I've ever been around, but just players to watch in the game. And kind of a funny story. He was a left tackle at Harvard. He's from Minnesota. He's from St. Paul area. Same high school as Joe Mauer. And he goes to Harvard, left tackle, great prospect. He's like a 6th round draft pick, the same draft class as Randy Moss, 1998. Mm-hmm. And my dad moves him to center. He was like, he still to this day said it was the greatest offensive line workout he's ever had. And moves him to center behind Jeff Christie for 2 years. And Jeff Christie, it was such a transition going from Jeff Christie, who looked like Jason Kelsey, even tinier than Jason Kelsey. He was like 278 playing center and pulling and doing all that stuff. And then all of a sudden here comes Matt Burke at 6'4", 320 pounds.
Yeah.
Big neck plate, big. He had the bar down the middle face mask. And I really want to say it's the first kind of modern center that I can like picture him in a Kreutz. You know, Kreutz is a little smaller though. But just one of just getting a big guy that can move, but just so smart. Obviously, he went to Harvard, but just having that, the pass protection they did then, it was like he was able to do so much, and Dante didn't have to do anything because Burke was just so smart pointing everything out. And honestly, like Alex Mack is the best modern comparison because that was just a similar type of player. Alex Mack's a little more athletic, but Burke could just do that stuff and was a mauler as well. But it was just awesome. One of my favorite players I've ever been around. Just so much fun to talk football with, and someone I've known for a long time too. But yeah, Matt Burke is probably my other Homer pick that I'm going to knock out. I don't think I have any more after that.
I have always impressed by guys who can switch teams and just never miss a beat. And he went to Baltimore and just instantly helped solidify their offensive line for those couple years, which I always am impressed by. How close were you to trying to put Dante Culpepper on this list?
Very close.
I considered it. I considered it. Because
there's people forget that 2004 year, man. I mean, he was
incredible that year. And the thing, I went back and I watched a lot of Dante Culpepper before we did this. I ultimately did not put him on. I do have a quarterback, but it's not Dante Culpepper. And the thing that I think I even forget, the arm is undeniable, right? Yeah. Like, we know that he could just launch the ball out of the stadium in a way very few guys ever could. I remember talking to Todd Downing for a story I wrote about the best quarterback receiver connections over the last 20 years. And he told me about Dante and Moss, and just watching those two guys, it's, and just watching Dante throw the ball, just in terms of pure distance and putting the ball down the field, one of the best deep ball throwers in NFL history.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what gets overlooked is how incredible of an athlete he was early in his career, especially at that size.
Yeah.
I mean, not just, he could really, really run. I'm not talking about like Ben Roethlisberger extending plays. Like, he could take off down the field at like 240 pounds. It was ridiculous.
His first start in 2000 against the Bears, he had 3 rushing touchdowns. And it was like, I mean,
crazy.
And one of them was, you know, red zone, because he like couldn't read anything then. He like barely watched film probably. But it was just, you know, with him, it was exactly what you said. And also, in terms of how accurate he was, I think he set some completion percentage, I think, in college. Can't remember if it was season or career, like he battled Steve Young or something like that. But he was just unbelievably accurate and just, could launch it downfield. And that Urlacher would always talk about, it was the first quarterback he ever had to get worried about trucking him, like actually lowering his
shoulder.
They're the
same size.
He's legitimately 265. They had to like, my dad always had to get on about weight because he would bounce between 265 and 275. And I mean, running.
That's insane.
And the only thing was just he had the tiny hands. That was the one detriment, is that he had a lot of fumbles. But Dante was insane, man. Dante had a couple of years where he would just do things like the deep ball stuff. I talk about the sound it makes, like when everybody would stand up at the Metrodome.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was almost so automatic that it was like I got spoiled, like just thinking, oh yeah, deep balls aren't one out of five. Like they, with Dante, they were like 50-50 balls, truly, like even every post route, everything to Moss. And it was just how accurate he was. There's a game against the Saints where he threw into the back corner to Moss. That was like, it's one of my favorite
throws.
Oh,
that's my favorite one. That one was just like a rocket ship taking off. I remember that one was incredible. And when I went back and I wrote about them, that was my, that was my favorite one that I saw. I absolutely love that one.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, so you just gave your overlooked offensive lineman. I'm going to do the same.
Love it.
Mine is Brian Waters.
Nice.
So I just think that Chiefs team, I mean, I feel like people, that team is going to be lost to history just in terms of how good those offenses were because they fizzled in the playoffs. So from 2000 to 2010, the Chiefs were the most efficient rushing team in the league by a wide, wide margin over that 10-year stretch. That's the entirety of his career in Kansas City. Undrafted, was on the Cowboys, got released. They went sent him to NFL Europe, and then he came back for the 2000 season. Essentially became a starter for a decade plus at that point. The Chiefs led the NFL in rushing DVOA in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, and were third in 2005.
Unbelievable.
And in the same way that a guy like Simeon Rice is going to get overlooked because of the people around him, the fact that Will Shields and Willie Roaf are on that offensive line, Brian Waters is the forgotten player among that group. Yep. But when you watch him play, he was so good. I mean, just climbing to the second level and just the movement skills, he makes the position look easy in a way that I really appreciate. And the way that a guy like Marshall Yanda does, where like just the ability to understand leverage and just how quickly to come off stuff. And when he got later into his career, I watched the game that the Chiefs played in 2010 against the 49ers earlier today. And watching him play against Justin Smith was great. But at that point in his career, the Chiefs are running a lot of like delayed runs and draws. And his ability to just throw guys by, use their momentum against them, it just the savviness that he developed later in his career was incredible. But he could also go toe-to-toe with Justin Smith, who was probably the strongest interior lineman in the entire league at that point. And then my favorite thing is that he gets done with the Chiefs in 2010. His contract is up. He leaves the Chiefs. Phone does not ring. The Patriots call him a week before the season starts in 2011 when Dan Connolly gets hurt. He goes to New England, switches to play right guard for the first time in his career with a week of prep, starts 16 games, plays at an insanely high level for a 2011 Patriots offense that breaks a bunch of records and goes to the Super Bowl. Like, that guy made football along the offensive line look much, much easier than he had any right to do.
Those Chiefs teams, especially with Trent Green at quarterback, people remember they were a juggernaut.
they were incredible. They were absolutely incredible.
With Tony Gonzalez, I mean, they were monsters. And yeah, there's a reason they had Priest Holmes and Larry Johnson, like just like without missing a beat at all. Like, you know, like when they just went back to back, and it was just, now they're just churning out 1200 yards, 1400 yard rushers, like where the backups look great. That's not by mistake, but no, great pick. He was on my list as well. So I'm glad you brought him up as well. Cause I wanted,
he was one of your five.
Yeah. Not my five. He was on the next up list. Yeah.
Oh, that would have been incredible. Okay. Who's your next one?
But he was on it. He's in red. Okay. There's a lot of different directions I want to go, but I'm just going to go with, oh man, this is tough. I'm going to go with the bane of my childhood, Mike Allstott.
Wow. Okay. All right.
because I don't think he'll ever get in. And I
he will not get in.
Yeah, exactly. But man, it just, I mean, those NFL Central, NFC Central years were just the worst with Mike Allstott, because just seeing, especially with the Vikings not having great defenses then, it was just awful. It was just how many times it was like a third and two turned into a 15 yard gain, or like a fourth and one, they're milking the clock and they turn into a 20 yard touchdown. It would just be nightmares. But kind of an iconic player, like look and play style wise. Like everyone remembers Mike Allstott. You remember number 40 and you remember the big grill face mask. I liked watching him. I would always trade for him when I played video games because I loved Mike Allstott. And he was like the last of the classic fullbacks, because like back in the day, like a fullback was actually maybe your main running back, like just how they titled positions. Like it was, halfback and, you know, fullback. So it was like he was like kind of that last fullback where it was like he blocked and then on the next snap he was, you know, he was still getting like 12 to 15 carries and a couple catches, you know. So just that kind of last of a generation type of guy. And I just love Mike Allstott, so I wanted to throw him out here.
So not a lot of people know this, but I had a brief dalliance with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when I was a young person.
Oh wow.
For about a 3 to 4 year stretch where I left the Bears as like a 7, 8, 9 year old, and it was mostly because of Mike Allstott.
Love it. Because
he was from Joliet, and then he played at Purdue. Yep. So he's like a Midwestern guy. That was right when the Bucks got their new jerseys.
Yep.
It was like right when he was coming into prominence.
I think they got those.
It was like 97. Yep. That was his first year as an All-Pro. So I loved those Tampa Bay teams. I was like, I had a Mike Allstott jersey. I had a framed autographed Mike Allstott picture in my room when I was a kid. I mean, he really was.
He's
so
iconic.
I was very, very into those Tampa Bay teams. And I eventually was like, you know what? It's time. I'm going back to the Bears. But those like late 90s, early 2000s Bucks teams, and it wasn't because they were that good yet. It was before they got really good, but they were in the NFC Central, so I watched them a bunch.
Yep.
And so that was when I was going to a lot of Bears games, and I was watching them play the Bucks a lot. So that happened. It's a little known fact about my life that I cheated on the Bears for like 3 years with the Buccaneers.
I'm glad I can bring up old flames for you.
Thank you. But I really appreciate that.
I remember I met him years and years ago when I was a kid, and like him without pads was still one of the most shocking things I've ever seen in my life. Because
his traps were just monstrous. Yeah, I mean, the guy looked.
And just like seeing him in person, it was just like, oh my God, you're exactly how I pictured you. Like just a square. And yeah, but yeah, my number 40, man. And just, and seeing him like, also like sometimes like he would have, actually, I want to have a spoiler because this might be another guy I talk about, but seeing him like just watching highlights and him just bouncing off guys is just like one of the most fun things to watch, especially how modern NFL is, seeing like 22 personnel on first and 10. It's just great to watch.
I wanted to run the ball because of Mike Allstott, but I unfortunately did get to play a little bit of running back in like sixth grade. I got to run the ball a couple different times, but my time as a running back and skill position player was very short lived. All right. Let's stick with NFC Central, NFC North guys here. My next guy is Nick Collins.
Okay. Packer
Nick legend. Collins is somebody that I think a lot of younger people probably don't know who he is. I'm sure like won't know who he is in the future, unless you're a Packers fan and maybe your dad or your brother like regales you of stories about like the 2009 Packers, but was incredible for like a 3 year stretch. He had 17 interceptions between 2008 and 2010. He had 7 picks in 2008. He scored 3 touchdowns. And he was just one of those guys that could play center field and make an incredible amount of plays on the ball. I mean, during that stretch, it was him, Ed Reed, and Troy Polamalu were like the safeties in the NFL. And then he had that neck injury in 2011, and that was essentially the end of his career. At his peak, when you watched him play, this is a guy who was a converted corner who ran 4.35 at the combine coming out of Bethune-Cookman. He was like 2.10.
Yeah.
So he played safety, but his range was out of control. There was a pick that he had against the Ravens. I can't remember what year it was. It might have been in that 08 season where he was on the right hash and the Ravens ran a flea flicker and he had an interception outside the numbers on the opposite sideline somehow. Like the amount of ground that guy covered, and when he picked the ball off, in his mind, he was going to score.
Yeah.
And like those Bears teams were like that. I always appreciated players like that. Like he had that same mindset that Ed Reed did every single time the ball was in his hands. And it was just awesome to watch. Like that was one of those guys where as a Bears fan, I just couldn't help but love watching Nick Collins play.
There's a lot of those Packers players that are like that for me.
It's so true.
Oh my God. Like Al Harris, man. Like I love to hate him. Like that was, he was okay. I mean, he was pretty good. He was a good starter, but he wasn't even like some like all-star, but to me, he was like, that's the guy I always had to watch. Him and KGB, those guys, man.
I was like that with Colin Jenkins. Colin Jenkins was just like a mindlessly good player for 10 years.
There's some of those guys. You just, because that's the thing. You watch them twice a year. And then you also, because if you're in a playoff race, you watch their other games. So you get to know everybody in the division when you watch them year after year after year. Certain guys just become like, I hate that guy. A lot of slot receivers become that too. When they're there for like 6 years, just catching first downs one after another. Those guys too.
Did you have anybody that was like injury concerns that you just thought didn't play for long enough, and that's why you considered throwing them on the list?
Yeah, injuries, but I kept him off. But injuries, but also he might have been too good. Was Peter Boulware?
Oh yeah, that was a name I came across in doing this. Yes,
that was one. I was like, man, I rewatched him. It's fun going back and watching a lot of these guys because now I kind of know it in a different sense, and it's like, some of them you get a new appreciation for because you watch them, you're like, holy shit, they were dominant. Like every snap, like those Ravens, watching the 01 Ravens again, or 2000 Ravens, I should say. Whew, that was something.
There were a couple teams that were more prominent as I went through this than I thought they would be. Those Ravens teams definitely were. Chris McAllister is a name that I considered. Chris McAllister was incredible back in the day. And another team that I had a lot of guys that I did not expect were those early to mid 2000s Jags teams. And the position specifically was the Marcus Stroud, John Henderson defensive tackle duo. When I was younger, I used to think that video of John Henderson getting slapped in the face before he went onto the field was the coolest thing in the history of the world.
I've seen it in person. Like,
that's
terrifying.
Awesome.
It's terrifying. I've seen it in person. It's terrifying.
Those teams were cool, man.
They were.
Those teams with those two, Mike Peterson, Rasheen Mathis, like Reggie Nelson was a young player on those teams.
Yeah.
And then the offense, like David Garrard was fun during that stretch.
MJD,
like,
Mercedes Lewis, Fred Taylor. Yep. Oh, yeah.
I enjoyed those teams. I was convinced the great Matt Jones. 07 when they played great Matt Jones, when they played the Patriots, and I did not like the 2007 Patriots. I was like, man, they were just too good. I did not like them. And I was convinced that the Jags were going to beat them in the divisional round that year. And because for whatever reason, I was just convinced it was going to happen. And that was the game where Brady completed like 21 of his first 22 passes in that game.
Insane. They tried to play quarters, I think, against them, against that offense. Yep. And it was like, let's just let him have it. And he was just hitting seam ball after seam ball after seam ball.
Well, that was the thing back then, right? Is that if you played zone against him, he was just going to slice and dice you to no end.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Steelers tried to do the same thing to him back in those days, and it just never worked. Like there was just no good answer.
And it was just, they would just high low you to death. Like it was just pick your poison. So if you're on quarters, they would just run mills on you with Moss going deep and somebody working inside on it. It was they crushed you no matter what you ran. That game was vivid. The week before they beat the Steelers in Pittsburgh, and that was like one of my favorite like sporting watch experiences. I remember
it was the day before I left for London and for my semester abroad. I remember it vividly.
Okay.
And watched the Jags game in London.
Awesome.
That's why I remember it so well.
The game was so great. It was so awesome. But those Jags teams were fought. They really were, especially how they played, because it was pretty old school with having 6'7", 340 pound D tackles and having two of them.
Super tough. Just super tough guy football. And also the uniforms were a big help.
Yeah.
Like when they wore those all black uniforms coolest looking team in the NFL.
Especially
them and the Ravens.
Game.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yep. And those playoff games were night games.
Yep.
That's why I was just like, that is a great looking team. My high school team wore all black uniforms at home. It was the greatest decision. If you can wear all black uniforms and you don't do it, you're just leaving it on the table. Like that's a terrible misstep.
It's an automatic. Right. It should be an automatic.
Who's your next one?
Oh man, this guy might be a little too good for this discussion, but I have to because I enjoyed watching him so much. It's Corey Dillon.
That's right on the edge, but I'll allow it.
I know that, especially when you said Fred Taylor, I was like, okay, it's same notch, but clock killing Corey Dillon, man. I loved just complete gameness, big dude with size and speed combo. Actually rewatching him, kind of Nick Chubbish a little bit, has the big stiff arm and kind of, and where he's bigger body, about 225, 230, but like kind of has that great start, stop and feet and kind of just that natural feel. It's just, he played for the Bengals, which doesn't help. And then also just he wasn't very friendly, I think, with the media. So it kind of didn't help either. But going to the Patriots, you know, kind of he had the big year with them, kind of tapered off after his career. But, you know, there's for guys, he only played for 10 seasons, but there's only a few guys above him not in the Hall of Fame that have more careers than him, like Adrian Peterson, Frank Gore, Fred Taylor, and Steven Jackson. So I kind of figure he might be that notch below, so we can conclude it.
Steven Jackson was right on the edge for me. Steven Jackson is a name that I considered, but was right on the edge for me.
These three backs, I just wanted to talk about all three, though. It was like Fred, Steven, and Corey Dillon. Like, I was like, I'm glad all three got a mention in this, because it was like that, those three were that tier where I was like, ah, man, maybe a little too good. But Corey Dillon,
Steven Jackson played on those terrible Rams teams. I was looking at some of his numbers and some of the supporting cast on those Rams teams. In 2007, that was the year where Orlando Pace got hurt, so Alex Barron had to play left tackle for the entire year.
Right.
Alex Barron led the league in penalties as an offensive lineman, I think 3 years in a row, which is really, really difficult to do.
That's hard.
And that year, like, Richie Incognito even got hurt. Like, 37-year-old Todd Stussy started like 8 games for that 07 Rams team. Steven Jackson was just running into brick walls. He was a 240-pound back who I believe caught 90 passes in one season.
Great hands.
Like, there were very few guys that could, that were built like Steven Jackson and could play like Steven
Great
Jackson.
Screen guy. Great screen guy, because good hands, and also just like he had that natural feel and space, and he just fell off a cliff like most backs do at the end. But like, you don't really see a lot of
big guys like that.
6'3", yeah, 6'2", 6'3", 240 pounds with sweet feet like that. Yeah, Steven Jackson. And also he rocked 39, which I always appreciated. You know, he took the unique number route, like kind of like Kamara does with 41. I always appreciate guys that do that a little bit. But yeah, those backs, and Fred Taylor, of course, you know, just so much better than people make him out to be, and just good do-it-all running back.
There were a couple other Bengals that I thought were interesting. I know they he didn't play with these guys because he left like 1 year early, but like Chad Johnson, I think it might be on the line for being a little bit too good. And then I considered Carson Palmer for this. Like, Carson Palmer, I don't think is ever going to be in the Hall of Fame, but we've talked a lot about those late career Carson Palmer teams in Arizona. Super exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was early in his career with those Bengals teams, he was incredible. Like, Carson Palmer is one of the more physically gifted quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that's not, I'm not really saying he was the number one pick in the draft. He won the Heisman. But that guy, when he was at his best, watching him sling it was truly enjoyable.
It really was. Because he's, when people, I hate to say it, but the prototypical quarterback. Like, I mean, his size and build and just his feet in the pocket and just
better athlete than people remember.
Correct. That's what no one remembers, is like, he was a pretty good athlete. Like, he was like a 4.7 to change guy. Like, at being at 230 though, that's saying something. Yeah. But he was just so much fun, because it's that classic big arm, but it was actually accurate. So he could truly push down the field and actually do it. Like, it's not like, oh my god, that's 10 yards over his head. That's why it was so much fun to watch in that Arians offense, because it was the first time I've really seen it be truly unlocked by a quarterback willing to stand there and push it downfield.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner StubHub has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
All right, so I'm going to give you my quarterback here. I went with Tony Romo.
Okay. Tony Romo might get the post-career bump.
Well, so if you look at it, I think it's going to be really, really hard for him to ever make the Hall of Fame. He's 34th all-time in passing yards. He made 4 Pro Bowls. That's it. He's behind Jay Cutler and Alex Smith in career passing yards.
I didn't know that.
Russell Wilson and Andy Dalton will both probably pass him this year. If Andy Dalton needs like 400 yards. So his career numbers, I think it's going to be difficult. But if you look at the efficiency numbers for Romo, obviously injuries are part of that. From 2006 to 2015, here are the quarterbacks with better efficiency numbers than Tony Romo. Okay, ready? Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Drew Brees, Russell Wilson, Philip Rivers.
Not bad.
Five of those guys are no doubt about it Hall of Famers. I think Russell Wilson is. And my stance on Philip Rivers has been well documented. Like, I think Philip Rivers is closer to that group than he is to the group behind him.
Agreed.
So the fact that Tony Romo is right there with those guys doesn't surprise me, but I think it might surprise some people. I feel like the announcing thing, I think, can go two different ways. I think it's going to keep him in the consciousness, but I also think there are going to be a lot of kids that are 10 years younger than us who are just going to know Tony Romo as the CBS guy and look at some of his career totals and the playoffs, lack of playoff success, and just think Tony Romo maybe wasn't that good of a quarterback. Tony Romo was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Like, Tony Romo was really, really good. That 2014 Dallas Cowboys offense remains one of my favorite groups of players, and just yes. The way they played. Like, the line was out of this world good. Yep. Like, they were, I think that was the best they ever were.
Oh, yeah.
Was that those five?
That was Zach Martin's rookie year. Yeah.
So that was Zach Martin's rookie year. Frederick was already there. That was Tyron Smith at his peak. Ronald Leary, I think, was the left guard on those teams. He was playing really well back then. So the running game was incredible. But in my mind, it was like, oh, you know, they ran the ball really well. They were super efficient. They didn't ask Tony to do a lot. But his ability to play point guard in that offense when they would spread it out, he had such a good sense for the game. Like, mm-hmm. the way he saw it and his ability to distribute the ball was so, so good. And the other thing, remember we talked a couple weeks ago about quarterbacks that can get you a bucket?
Yes.
Tony Romo could get you a bucket. And yes. That is the thing about him that I think is a little bit different than some of those other really, really great quarterbacks outside of Rodgers. Obviously, outside of structure, Rodgers can do a lot of stuff. But Romo's ability to ad lib and make stuff happen when things broke down, I think that is kind of an underrated aspect of his game, but he's not just that. He wasn't just somebody that needed those secondary reaction plays. He was a really, really good quarterback within structure too. Like, I just feel like there's a chance that 10 years from now, people don't remember how good he actually was at the game.
The game I always remember is the one he threw for 500 yards against the Broncos. And yes. It was like, yes. 2013. And it kind of sums him up perfectly. 500 yards, goes toe to toe with prime Manning with the Broncos.
And they lost
51-48. And you know how they lost? He throws a pick and then they just milk the clock and kick a field goal to win it after he just brings them back with this huge, huge come, like, all these points toe to toe with prime Manning. And it's just like, that kind of sums up Tony Romo. It's like, that's why so many times probably there were times where people just go, oh, he's not that good, because they all of a sudden they just remember that one bad play and not the 500 yards and 48 points
exactly.
that he put up before.
Exactly. I honestly think that if he played now, I would appreciate him even more.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's somebody that when I was younger, I didn't appreciate the little nuances of his game in the way that I probably would now. And that's why every time I go back and watch him, I find my appreciation for him growing and growing, just because there's so many little things he did. I was like, man, that's really good.
And that's the thing. I kind of knocked him probably for years, not knocked him, but kind of like kept him a little lower in my brain, because I always just thought the quarterback had to operate from the pocket. And if you're scrambling around, that means you don't know the offense and you're guessing and you're a gunslinger, which is fine, but you can't win that way. And then I realized that as I got older, it's like, no, you need that. And it's like, maybe, you know, it's just that gunslinger mentality was just, I agree with you. I think he's phenomenal. He was a legit MVP candidate. And it was just like, he was one of those players that just could take over a game. And that's a guy you should talk about and treat that way, but sometimes they just get lost into the history.
It's interesting because when people talk about Burrow, his name never comes up, but like their physical skill sets actually remind me a little bit of each other, where they don't have those huge arms, but they can make things happen. They can, you know, there's a little good bit of athlete. Pocket mobility, good athlete, but not great, really accurate with the ball. Like, he's not a name that comes up when people talk about Burrow a lot, but when I watched him, that's what I was thinking about.
Romo's bigger than also people remember too. Like he's 6'2", I think, but he was like 230 and change. Like he was thickly built. So like, yeah, that's a great comparison with Burrow because he's kind of the same way. He's so just, you know, stout with the athleticism.
All right, who's your next one?
Oh man, I want to get away from the running back, Ron. For me, I'm going to go with Patrick Surtain.
He was on my short list as well.
Yeah, because how I remember Surtain, it was looking back, and it's funny how my memory remembers him as like 8-time Pro Bowler, 7-time All Pro, best in the league for 8-10 years. That's what it felt like to me because he was very good from 02 to 04. And that makes sense because that's right when I kind of like focused on the league. It's when my dad became a head coach. So it makes a lot of sense because that's who I was like, that's the best corner. We need corners because we suck at corner Vikings. So I want to know who the best corners were. Sorry, there's a couple. Sorry, Brian Williams, who's pretty good. But so with Surtain, though, it was like he had that 3 to 4 year stretch and he's just had that cutoff. He didn't get past that. I kind of noticed this recently, but looking back at some of these old corners, how many drop off a cliff once they turn 30 or once they the past their year 30 season, they turn 31. It's like, injured, 6 games, 4 games, 10 games out of the league. And it's like 2 seasons before they're a Pro Bowler. And it's kind of crazy. Surtain was one. You also brought up McAllister. He was another one. He dropped off after 30. And it's kind of funny, like looking back at it, the best ones, of course, you know, the Champ Baileys of the world, they just go on and on and on. But it is kind of crazy to see how much the corner position just drops off at a certain age, what other positions we associate with that, but maybe corners one that we should look at that way as well.
So, is Asante Samuel too good for something like this? Because he was on my very short list. He led the league in interceptions, I think, over the course of his entire career. He comfortably led the league in passes defense over the course of his entire career. And watching him play, I went back and I watched a decent amount today because I really considered putting him on. I was like, he might be too good. But his ability to bait quarterbacks and play off and play downhill, and whether it was either in cover two or just playing off man and bailing out and then coming downhill on stuff. I mean, he got Peyton Manning several different times. And when you can consistently do that to Peyton Manning, that says a lot about the way that you're playing the position. It's funny that both of those guys, their sons are now in the league and were drafted this year.
Same
like
draft
that
class.
Wave of kids of former NFL defensive backs and just the way those guys clearly have a leg up with the nuances and the tiny little details of the position. Like, I think that's going to be really cool to watch because it's happening pretty consistently.
And it's the first time that corner play that can translate because it's like when they were actually playing, it wasn't like, oh, like, because there's such a disconnect, I think, for guys our age, because football was so different from the adults, like when we were in high school and college. Like, it's accelerated so much in this past 10, 15 years that I think, these guys that are in actually like, oh, no, I played in a similar man system, like literally the same man system that he played in New England is getting run now by a couple teams. So that's kind of cool. Like, when you think about it, it's not that long ago. But no, great. I think Asante Samuel's another one. I don't think he's, man, he's right at that cutoff of too good. But if I'm going to include Corey Dillon, he's kind of the corner version of that.
But he has not been a finalist. He's been eligible a couple different times, and he hasn't even been on anywhere near the list, and which is kind of surprising to me. So
50 picks. He had 51 interceptions.
50 picks. He had 51 interceptions. 50 interceptions.
Yeah, I know. I'm just looking at his stats right now. Especially on to winning teams, they get national recognition and stuff like that. That's what always so surprising. There's a reason, and he probably played in that defense too because he was physical as hell. Because you had to be play man in that defense with New England.
All right, my last one here is another Bear, and it's Lance Briggs.
And thank you for saying him.
so here's the thing. And when I was doing it in my mind right away, I was like, oh, too good. Like 7-time Pro Bowl or whatever has not been anywhere close to a semifinal list as far as I understand it. And I don't think he will be just because that position, there are so many guys I think that are going to come up and block him, whether it's Thomas Davis or now Luke Kuechly is going to be eligible here soon. Derek Brooks got in. I just don't think and Brian Urlacher obviously is in. It feels like he's going to be overlooked here. And I think it's not for this reason, but I think this may contribute to it. We talk about Peanut Tillman existing in a small time frame. Lance Briggs is the perfect player for the early to mid 2000s, like the perfect linebacker,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And so playing in that cover two system in Chicago, he's just a hook player.
Yep.
He doesn't have to have any range in coverage whatsoever
nope.
because what's asked of him. So he was a good pass defender, but it's because he didn't have to move very much.
Correct.
But when you look at what he did in that defense, I truly believe he was the best downhill linebacker of his generation.
Yeah.
So from 2003 to 2014, his 12 years in the league, he ranked 14th in tackles for loss. Everyone else above him on that list is a defensive lineman, except for Carlos Dansby, who had 300 more pass rush snaps over that time period than Lance Briggs. So you have a guy playing in a blitz-happy system in Dansby who's always moving toward the line of scrimmage. Lance Briggs played in a system where he didn't blitz almost ever. He had like two or three sacks a season.
Yeah.
But for the most part, that's not what they did. And he's still making plays behind the line of scrimmage consistently.
Yep.
He was right near the top of the league in defeats, that Football Outsider stat that I love. That's essentially just how much shit do you wreck on a play-by-play basis. He was always up there. I can't remember a Will linebacker over that stretch, over that 10 years, that was consistently better at slipping blocks, getting off blocks. He just, his ability to diagnose and make plays in the run game, I think was unparalleled for anybody else that played over that stretch.
It's such a specific skill set and size, because Urlacher, I mean, is gigantic, and so is Briggs. Like, they're big, big linebackers, and it was just so needed for what they did, because if you're plugging the run with six guys in the box, you know, like those linebackers got to take some hits, you know, they got to fit up on stuff and they got to slip stuff, like you said, and they ran up. Oh, it's so beautiful. Guys post all the time on Twitter, but they'll just post, you know, the fits that these old Bears teams used to do. And it's just so beautiful watching the two linebackers just thump, thump, and just wreck stuff for a 1 yard gain. And it's like, you can tell the offense going like, that should have been a lot better than that. Okay. And then like, they just bait guys in, like we've talked about what the Rams defense doing, but just those guys doing it, which is truly two guys in the middle, just plugging shit up. It was awesome. I love Lance Briggs too. I'm so glad you mentioned him, because he was on my list, but I figured you would hit him, but I wasn't sure if you would say he was too good or not.
I mean, I feel like he is too good, but I still don't think he's going to get real recognition for the Hall of Fame. So I think that's why he fits here for me.
Even when he was playing, he didn't get it.
Yes, because Urlacher's there, right?
Yep.
It's like the fact that Urlacher is standing next to him.
There can't be
two.
There just can't be two. You know, people just have that in their mind.
It's just so weird. I think it's going to be interesting to watch the recognition for the Seahawks guys as we get there. Like, who's going to get it? Who's not? Like, in my mind, I think Sherman and Wagner are walk-in Hall of Famers.
Yeah.
Like, walk-in Hall of Famers. I think Earl Thomas, probably should be too.
Oh,
but the way that works, like, I think 10 years from now, Michael Bennett is the perfect guy for this sort of exercise. Like, I don't think he's going to be a Hall of Famer, but I think he absolutely applies for something like this.
That's exactly right.
With Briggs, the play that sticks out to me the most is that 2006 year against Seattle in the divisional round. Tie ball game, fourth quarter. Seattle has the ball. It's fourth and one at the 2 minute warning on the Bears 42-yard line. And he makes the play 2 yards deep in the backfield and they win that game. And without that, I don't think they go to the Super Bowl. Obviously, they lost, but those are just the plays he made all the time. I mean, that guy was just making consistent tackles in the backfield everywhere, all of the time. And in that era, he was just the perfect linebacker for what they wanted to do. I don't know what he would look like now, but it doesn't matter. I mean, that's the whole point.
He'd be like a five tech.
All right. Any other guys that you wanted to mention before we get out of here? Those are our 10 players. This was very fun.
This was fun. My kind of best at arrest, Sean Rogers was one. Almost threw him out
Sean
there.
Sean Rogers is another a great one. Chris Jenkins was on my short list.
Chris Jenkins.
So
okay.
Similar kind of player.
And then two that I almost thought were, they might end up in the Hall. So I kind of held off on them was Lorenzo Neal and Ted Washington. Kind of like best of their position.
God.
I almost
yes.
said Ted Washington.
Yes.
Ted Washington was almost my last one I said instead of Surtain, just because he was the prototypical nose tackle. We'll never see another one like him. For like 390, plugging. He played until he was 39 years old. Like, I mean, just ridiculous. Just what he did in his career. And Lorenzo Neal.
Where did he end his career? New England?
I really want to say Cleveland.
He did end in Cleveland. He had two years in Cleveland.
Okay. And he was 39,
God,
right?
He had four more seasons after that season with the Patriots.
Unbelievable, man. Ted Washington.
Well, the best
man.
Part was, and he had that those 2 years with the Bears, and the 2001 Bears, it was him and Tractor Trailer.
Yeah.
Were next to each other. The Bears had like 900 pounds of defensive tackle on those
I
teams.
I love it. I love
it. The 2001 Bears were not anywhere close to the best Bears team of my
I
lifetime.
I remember that year.
It was insane.
Couldn't believe it.
Because it was the two straight weeks where they had pick sixes to win the game with Mike Brown against the Niners and the Browns. That 2001 Bears team was so wild. And I will say,
crazy. I remember
that. I put two Bears on my list. You could put five, I think, from this era, and you could make legitimate arguments for them. You mentioned Olin Kreutz.
Yeah.
Olin Kreutz absolutely could apply here. He was the second team center on the all-decade team. I don't think we'll ever get into the Hall of Fame. And the other guy, two other guys, I would say, Tommy Harris.
Yep. Okay, good.
Was incredible.
Yeah.
Before Tommy Harris got hurt, that prototypical attacking, penetrating three technique, he was the guy.
Yep.
I mean, when he came out of Oklahoma, he was so, so good, and injuries just derailed his career. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Matt Forte. Like,
oh, yeah.
Those Bears teams were made up of guys in this range, which I think is one of the reasons I was very excited to do the exercise.
Just talk about all your favorite players just one after another. I only had one of the Viking. Who was? Yeah, I had Gary Anderson, the kicker, even though he missed the field goal. I mean, he was the points leader. He was on 80s and 90s all-decade team. I don't think he's ever going to get in. If he hasn't been in now, probably never going to get in. that was another Viking I had. Joey Porter was another one.
Joey Porter's a good one. Yep, Joey Porter's a really good one.
Yeah, I mean, this was a fun exercise for me. I mean, just talk guys are too recent. Like Patrick Willis is too recent. He might get in, but his career was just so short.
Way too good.
But that's the thing. Do you think, has anyone mentioned him in the last two seasons about like a guy that you were just talking about linebackers that could have been ahead of him? You'd even bring him up.
so he's a finalist though. I firmly believe that Patrick Willis should be in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, absolutely.
To me, it's not even a question. As far as I'm concerned, if Calvin Johnson belongs in the Hall of Fame, then yes, Patrick Willis belongs in the Hall of Fame.
Calvin Johnson was a good, that's a new trendsetter. That being, now the argument changes. Now it's about, were you at the peak of your position for a certain amount of time as opposed to longevity? Like now you can make that argument for some of these guys, which I think is great. So I guess Major Patrick Willis will have a chance now because, I mean, he had like a 7-year stretch for his best linebacker in the league. We're top three.
I 100% think he should be in. The guy from that team that I would say is more applicable here would be Navarro Bowman, who his peak was not as high and was not as long, but I think that he definitely would be in a conversation for something like this. Again, those Niners defenses were full of guys like this.
So
Navarro
many.
Bowman, Justin Smith, like they just had dudes like that. Nate Clements is somebody that you could probably throw out there as one of those guys. Like that's what those Niners defenses were outside of Patrick Willis, who is like an all-world player.
Well, but the thing is, it's people forget. they do, man. It's if you don't play like it's certain, you just have to be talked about. Like people have the memory of goldfish, and it's like if you're not like part of these certain teams, no one's gonna remember you. We all remember Saragusa, like like I mean, come on, like that's kind of how it works, though. But I completely agree with you that I think Patrick Willis should be in. Like I think he should be out. Easy vote for everybody, but it's just you never know with these voters now.
So I don't want to get too deep into the Hall of Fame arguments because let's just say that is a podcast for another time and another time possibly in the very near future. But that is all we have for today. I really enjoyed this. This is what June and July are for. So I really am glad that we did this. We will be back later this week with the next installment in our offseason interview series. It's in the NFL General Manager. I'm very much looking forward to it. So please come back and check that out. Please rate and review the podcast on your podcast platform of choice. That would mean a lot to me, even during the offseason. Please subscribe to The Athletic. We still have a lot of good stuff getting rolled out, even though some of the NFL staff is currently on vacation or is about to go. I'm telling you, you cannot follow the league without a subscription. Get yours in time for training camp. You're going to be happy that you did. TheAthletic.com/football show. We will be back on Friday with our next interview series installment. Until then, thank you guys for listening. We'll talk to you later.
This was The Athletic Football Show.
Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.